It's such a dissociative experience. You never want to think about it again. In those moments, you are telling yourself that that is the last time. This is the last time I'm going to eat a bag of M&Ms. This is the last time I'm going to lather bread with honey and salt and sugar and whatever it is. You make the weirdest concoctions when you have an eating disorder, but it's never the last time. And that's the biggest catch 22. You think, no, this is it. This is it. I don't need help because this is the last time. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up. It's going to be fresh. It's going to be a new day. But you have to admit this is something you struggle with.
Welcome to today's podcast episode. Thank you so much for pressing play. In today's episode, I have the incredible Steph joining me, also known as Mind Food Steph. Now, as you might have guessed from the title of today's episode, and even just the mere fact that Steph is joining me, this is going to be an episode where we are discussing topics that may be triggering for some people. And I actually hate that these topics, whilst they're triggering for many, I think they're so relatable to every single woman in varying degrees. I don't think every woman listening will have had experience with having bulimia personally, but I do think every woman who has pressed play today has had an experience in really questioning her relationship with food or her body, struggling with body image, struggling with control, restriction, diet culture. I know that this is a topic I have spoken about so frequently, and that's because it is such a, you know, it's not only relevant to women, but it is such a prominent topic and experience that women do go through. I often receive direct messages on Instagram from women who are struggling with some form of binge eating or disordered eating, and it breaks my heart, and I also know how it feels. I've spoken about my own experience with a variety of eating disorders, particularly in my early 20s. I've spoken about how I feel about recovery. And even in today's podcast episode, after we wrapped, there were certain things that I couldn't stop thinking about. And so I've actually recorded like a part two or an extension, or I guess maybe you just call it like a personal reflection on this topic. And that will be coming up shortly. So just keep an eye out for part two on this topic. But today is part one, and it's a conversation with Steph. So Steph is a clinical psychologist. She works in the area of eating disorders, disordered eating, ADHD, and more. You've likely heard Steph, whether that's on her own podcast or here, because she's joined me for many, many episodes. We've spoken about ADHD. We've spoken about the comorbidity of ADHD and eating disorders. She recently joined me for an episode where we were chatting about self-sabotage thoughts and behaviors. So I know that if you are a regular listener, you know exactly who Steph is, but if you're not, you can find her on social media under Mind Food Steph. This episode, as I mentioned, if you are struggling with disordered eating, please do reach out to someone that can support and help you. There are resources in the show notes, and you can also reach out directly to Steph as well and just have a discovery phone call with Steph and find out more about the ways in which she can support you to really live a binge-free life. I personally know how it feels to go from someone who has been binge eating and then to come out the other side and to say that, like, I've been free of binge eating disorder for over a decade now. When you are in binge eating disorder, it is so destructive. It is so painful. And it really does impact all areas of your life. And you can break free from it. You can make changes, and that's not to say it's easy, but it is possible. So in this chat, we go through Steph's 4 tips for becoming binge free. And as I mentioned, after we finished talking, there were just some things that I wanted to add to the conversation, or I guess share from my own personal experience. So keep an eye out for another episode on this topic, but from kind of a different perspective, because I think they work really well together. It's such a big topic. You can never cover it all in one conversation, but this episode is full of food for thought. So let's get into it. Just quickly, a word from today's sponsors. Unless, of course, you're one of our Venti members, in that case, there are no ads and your episode is about to keep playing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to today's episode. This is a conversation with Steph, and we are going to be chatting about living a binge-free life. And Steph tells me that she has got 4 clear steps to living that binge-free life.
I sure do. Thanks for having me, Kylie. I'm so excited to be here and give your listeners all the wisdom and knowledge that they need to work towards a life that isn't controlled by thoughts about food and their body image.
Amazing. I think perhaps it would be helpful to begin with defining what binging even really means, because binge can be quite a colloquial term that we throw around, like, oh, I had a binge on the weekend. And for one person, that just means they overate. And then for other people, a binge is very disastrous and very upsetting and very traumatic. And it means a lot more than just having slightly too much pizza in one sitting.
Absolutely. Now, there's nothing wrong with occasional binge eating. Binge eating stands for eating a large amount of food in a short period of time and feeling a loss of control. You also feel shame, guilt, even anxiety following the episode. So the difference is the level of distress it causes, and depending on how often this is happening, that's when it can be a binge eating disorder. So if it's occurred frequently over the last couple of months, at least weekly, it's causing clinically significant distress, it's impacting your life, then it could actually be a binge eating disorder. And 1 in 4 women who have gone on a diet within their lifetime have a likelihood of developing an eating disorder or disordered eating. So there's a really high percentage that women who are listening to this struggle with their relationship with food and may even struggle with binge eating.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Steph, but binge eating disorder often does go undiagnosed, doesn't it?
Yes. In fact, 75% of people with an eating disorder, and that includes binge eating disorder, bulimia, anorexia, all the eating disorders, will not seek help. 75% of people will not seek help for their eating because there is stigma, there is shame. But most importantly, women think if I just lose weight, then the problem will be fixed. Or they don't know they have a disorder. So many women come to me for one thing, or, you know, for ADHD or binge eating, but don't actually realize it's a disorder because it can be very normalized, similar to alcohol use. It just really depends on the severity and how much it's impacting your life. But you are right. It doesn't get picked up, especially in the medical field. Eating disorders they're getting better understood, but doctors specifically may not detect it as well as it could be detected. They're more likely to pick up on the anxiety or the depression that someone may report as a result of this.
And struggling with binge eating is a very real problem. I think sometimes it can get minimized or trivialized,
but it truly is impacting that individual. And maybe that's another reason why it doesn't get picked up so much, is because it's such a personal thing and it's not an easy thing for people to disclose.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of shame and stigma. I mean, not everyone with binge eating disorder may struggle with body image related concerns. There's actually a very high comorbidity with binge eating disorder and trauma. So people are using the food to self-soothe their emotions, to kind of block out difficult experiences. So yeah, unfortunately, it does go under the radar. It doesn't get reported enough. People may not think they're worth getting help with this. So it's a tricky one, but it is more common than people think.
Yeah. And I think too, even just thinking about what is it that binging gives someone? And that's kind of a weird thing to say, because when you think about binging, it's often thinking about what is it taking away from you. You know, it's a certain sense of unfreedom. But I think what it can give people is that sense of control, or that experience of numbing out, or, you know, even proving that belief that they are worthless. And that's why I imagine it's often linked to something traumatic in the past, because it's like, that part isn't healed, so let me heal it, in air quotes, let me numb it by using this binge experience as a way of escaping or proving the thoughts around that trauma.
Correct. And there's a couple of main reasons why people binge eat. And I also just want to mention bulimia here. So bulimia is a type of eating disorder where people binge eat, but then they compensate for it. So they have these binge eating episodes, but then they might make themselves vomit, or they take laxatives, or they compensate with overexercise. Whereas someone with binge eating disorder, they binge eat, but they're not compensating, because they may not be driven by the desire to change their weight, shape, and size, because it's driven by trauma, or it's driven by ADHD and trying to find dopamine. Whereas people with bulimia nervosa have a preoccupation with their body weight, shape, and size. They are fearful of weight gain, and that's why they're trying to overcompensate. Whereas it may not be the case in binge eating disorder. It might be, but not always.
So where would you suggest someone begins in terms of living that binge-free life?
Great question. The first step is to build your awareness around it. Binge eating and eating disorders, I remember myself, if someone asked me back in the day when I went through my eating disorder, like, oh, you've got to track your binges, you've got to write down what happens, I would have been mortified, because it's such a dissociative experience. You never want to think about it again. In those moments, you are telling yourself that that is the last time. This is the last time I'm going to eat a bag of M&Ms. This is the last time I'm going to lather bread with honey and salt and sugar and whatever it is. You make the weirdest concoctions when you have an eating disorder, but it's never the last time. And that's the biggest catch 22. You think, no, this is it. This is it. I don't need help, because this is the last time. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up, it's going to be fresh, it's going to be a new day. But you have to admit this is something you struggle with, and it's okay. So the first step is starting to track what's going on. And I offer a free binge eating tracker tool that you can download in the profile in my link. In the binge tracker tool, it's got the date, the time, the place, what you consumed, what thoughts and feelings you had. So essentially, you're identifying patterns. Now, if we want to change something, we have to build our awareness around it. So if you want to get started on changing this behavior, the first step is the data gathering phase. So you want to gather data on your binge eating, and that way you can start to figure out, oh, I'm always binge eating at 3 o'clock, or whenever I see my mother-in-law, that's when I'm binge eating. Because what we want to tease out is the patterns and the reasons this is occurring, because there's different reasons people binge eat, and once we pick those out, those reasons require different interventions.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
So I imagine some of those different reasons could come down to like physiological needs, such as, you know, you're starving yourself all day, so by 3 p.m. you're ravenous. Or it could be things like, okay, noticing that you are triggered because you maybe lost a little bit of control. Like at 3 p.m. you see other people having their afternoon tea and you crave a cake, so then you have a bite of a cake. Like there are so many different reasons, I imagine, that people could actually begin to identify. And then as you said, once you have the intel, you can then explore the right kind of salve for your particular activation.
Correct. And the four key reasons people binge eat is one, they're under eating. Women especially underestimate how much they should be eating. A lot of women think they should be eating as much as a toddler. They don't understand that your calories, you need basic calories to breathe and function throughout the day. So under eating.
And one carbs. I feel like people need to hear that as well. Carbs as well. Women are so afraid of carbs. And it's like, no, do you know that you actually need like a decent amount of carbohydrate each day for your brain to function?
Absolutely. It's very true. Just try going on a diet with no carbs. You will want to, get out of it very quickly. So under eating, massive cause of binge eating. Second one, dysregulated nervous system. If you're anxious, if you're stressed, if you're overwhelmed, if you are bored. So any emotions, boredom, that's another reason. Third one is events or moods. So kind of linked to emotions, but more sort of events that can then trigger those moods, or negative thoughts, such as, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that. I'm a failure. I might as well eat the whole bag. That leads you to binge eat. So this is why people just who try to control the behavior are never, ever successful. You will never be successful at stopping binge eating unless you rewire your thoughts. Because think about this. You eat a donut and you say, yum, that was a good donut. Nothing else happens. You get on with life, but it's the thoughts of eating the donut that set you on the spiral, not the donut. So then people cut donuts out, which is the worst thing you can do because restriction leads to binge. And then the last thing that drives binge eating is a lot of the time being intoxicated. So when you're drunk or you go for a big night out, but also a bad body image. If you have a bad body image, if you think you're disgusting, if you call yourself fat, if you just have poor self-esteem, you're going to, again, try to self-soothe with food. So unless we target those four things, you know, your food structure to make sure you're under eating, your regulation of your nervous system, unless we enhance your brain and your negative thoughts, and if we embrace your body image, notice that stands for the word free, then you'll always be trapped.
So are those the four areas that you want people to focus in on in regards, yes, to actually being able to make the change? Because I think it's really helpful for people to understand if they want to change that cycle that they are in, it is going to take effort. It's going to take them to be really committed and consistent with unpicking each of those areas.
Yeah. And this is four questions I ask whenever I jump on a call with someone is, number one, what is your food structure? Many people look at me like, what? What do you mean? People don't have structure. They skip breakfast. They forget to eat lunch. Then they're binge eating by 3 o'clock. There's no structure in their eating. Big red flag. Second thing, what do you do when you're stressed and overwhelmed? Do you have a strategy? What are your physiological strategies to manage your nervous system? I don't know. What do you mean? Like, oh, sometimes, you know, I might go for a walk or I might call someone. Don't have strategies to regulate your nervous system, second red flag. Third thing, what psychological strategies do you have to manage your negative thoughts? So when you get thoughts like, I'm fat, I'm disgusting, I don't deserve this, how do you deal with that? Oh, what? No, I don't know. I don't really deal with them. They're just there. Okay, last one. How do you feel about your body image? What do you do when you're having a bad body image day? Oh, it's the worst. So if you don't have strategies for these four areas, then you're really going to struggle, because overcoming binge eating and bulimia, don't forget about bulimia, requires a set of skills that people need to learn. That's it. If you don't have the skills, then you don't know how to do it. But people just think that they're failures because they can't do it, or they should be able to do it themselves. But just like you learn to diet, we need to learn to undiet.
Structure is so important. I know that when I was going through recovery with my eating disorder, it was very much about a structure. It was about three meals, three snacks. And for someone who is experiencing a eating disorder, that can be so incredibly confronting to release control and be like, okay, I'm going to trust into this new structure, because all sorts of beliefs come up. You know, you start going, oh my gosh, if I eat that, like if I eat at this certain time, maybe I won't be able to stop and that will start a binge. And so for someone who wants to introduce structure, do you recommend that they do go down that path of like three meals, three snacks, and having an actual meal plan? Because I feel like there are kind of different schools of thought when it comes to recovery. Some people are more like, follow your intuition and, you know, check in with yourself and what do you want to eat. And I laugh when I say that, because when you're going through recovery, you don't even know what your intuition is. And then I guess some people are like, oh, if you do bring in this structure, that's still disordered eating because you're having a plan.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I think that's the problem, is people just try to jump into one thing like, I'm going to become an intuitive eater. But it's like, no, we need to unpack the layers, because eating disorders stunt you of your hunger cues. They stunt you of your fullness cues. How the hell are you going to be intuitive when you don't even know when you're hungry or full yet? We need to introduce regular eating through food structure first, because that will get rid of 70 to 80% of the binges. Then later, once we have regular eating, your metabolism is going to start to heal. You're going to feel so much better. Your mood's going to be better, and you're going to be in a more cognitive, safe state to then do the more intuitive work down the line. But to answer your question, Kylie, yes, I say three meals and two to three snacks. Now, it doesn't matter what you eat. It doesn't matter how much you eat. So people still have that sense of control over, I can choose what to eat and I could choose how much I eat. So I'm not putting people on some strict meal plan or, you know, you got to eat this much, because that, like you said, it overwhelms people. So allow them to choose what they want to eat, as long as they follow the structure and they're eating within a 4-hour window each time.
Yeah, and following that structure then, I guess, just builds self-efficacy, that you have the ability to do what you say that you're going to do. And so then in turn, that leads on to building self-worth, and then building self-worth can only make it easier to recover and beat this thing.
Exactly. And we log all of this. So people do monitoring records, but they don't just log what they're eating. They're also logging their thoughts and their feelings. So then what I can see is, okay, when they log their food, and if they perceive this as a binge, you felt stressed and anxious because this and this happened. So any binges that aren't resolved through food structure, we then look at emotion regulation, which is pillar two of the four steps, regulating your nervous system. So food structure is F, R is regulating your nervous system. And then it's about teaching people, when your nervous system is activated, let's use some techniques before we go to food. So we're not saying don't binge eat. And like I say to people who do the program, your goal is to not never binge eat again. Your goal is when you binge eat, you're like, eh, it happened. And it's not distressing on your life anymore. So the severity, the frequency, the intensity, and the distress it causes is minimal.
Yeah, it's not informing how you go about the rest of your day and therefore impacting the rest of your life.
Precisely, exactly.
How important is support and community with this sort of thing? Because I imagine doing it on your own is really tough.
100%. People know what to do. You can Google this, and I will tell people every single step of the way. Like, I'm basically telling you my 12-week program. There's no secret. What people need is accountability, support, and implementation. And that's why you need a therapist or a program. And part of our program is we do have a community and we meet every week as a group, because the research shows, and this is for women with or without ADHD, the research shows that the most evidence-based strategies for dealing with, you know, ADHD and eating disorders is group work. So I've kind of brought all these things together in my 8 years of being a psychologist. I know what works and I've packaged it together in this awesome program. I think it's awesome. And community is such a big part of it. And it's so nice just seeing everyone pump each other up and support one another.
Yeah, I think when you're doing it in a group and you've got that visibility, it actually does allow you to have more compassion for yourself, because as humans, we're so hard on ourselves. But if we can see someone else going through something similar, all of a sudden you become like the most compassionate, the biggest cheerleader, and you have all of these reasons and all of these reasons to celebrate, and you can support someone. And so I think when you're doing it in a group and it's like, oh my gosh, you're realizing all of the behaviors can be quite similar and you're affording compassion and grace to someone else, it allows you to turn that compassion and grace inward as well.
Yes.
And to feel less alone, to feel less shame, to feel less like you're a terrible person who's doing this insane behavior on your own, because you realize it's not that at all. It's actually, unfortunately, a very common coping experience.
Yes. And you learn from other people in the group. So you can say, oh, Sally was asking about procrastination the other day, or Sally was struggling with, you know, a wedding and being in photos. I've got that coming up, so I can use what I learned from her coaching session in the group and what you recommended to her. And this is why it's so effective in 12 weeks. And I know it's effective because I take clinical data, pre and post program versus 10 years of trying to do it by yourself. The research is extensive and it shows that eating disorders linger and they remain unresolved because people sort of dip in and out of trying to get help. But when you're in a concentrated, intense, focused group and you do it well, that's usually all you need.
Also, I think when you make the commitment to other people, but also the commitment financially to have that 12-week coaching, you then do show up for it versus, oh, I could Google strategies, I could do X, Y, Z. It all becomes very wishy-washy. But I think when you're actually like, no, I was going to say Jesus take the wheel, but it's more like Steph take the wheel. You know what I mean? Like you're fully going, okay, no, like now is the time that I face this and I deal with it, and I'm refusing to live a life where my binge eating is in the driver's seat.
Exactly. You've got more skin in the game. When people pay for something, they value it more.
Where can listeners find out more about the 12-week program, Steph?
Oh, well, they can book a call directly with me. So it's free. It's a free one-on-one just to really unpack what's going on for that person and see whether they're a suitable candidate. I want to make sure that the program is going to work for them, that it is suitable for their needs. So if they book a free eating evaluation call in my link or the show notes below, we will talk about it and we can get them into the next intake. And the great thing is the course is all online. You do it at your own pace, but you have access to it for life. So this is a lifetime opportunity. You've got access to it forever. And yeah, have a chat with me. Let's see if you're suitable. And then we go from there.
Amazing. I will make sure we have all of the information in the show notes. And I did want to just mention that even though it is an online course, you do still have coaching calls, don't you, that are live.
So yes,
it's weekly. Someone's just watching a video, they're actually getting access to you, a psychologist.
Correct. And it's the only way I work closely with people in this area. So it's weekly group coaching, but then I also send weekly check-ins. So I'm reviewing your homework, sending feedback. You've got the group chat. So we work very closely together, which is nice.
And for anyone who doesn't know you or follow you, they can find you by searching at MindFoodSteph. Is that right?
That's the one.
Perfect. I will make sure we have that info in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing your top tips on living a binge-free life.
You are welcome. Have the best week. Bye.
Now, before you run away, I just wanted to slide in and remind you that I do have another episode on this topic coming up for you very, very soon. Make sure you press the little plus sign, the little follow icon there, because you can follow the podcast. It doesn't cost you a single thing to follow. If you enjoy this style of episode, make sure you jump on over, leave a review. And if you happen to be a IM podcast subscriber, thank you so much. I appreciate you being here. Today's podcast episode was recorded on the land of the Bundjalung Nation. In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.